In July 2014, Craig's New York Business reported some dismal statistics for the Metropolitan Opera. Peter Gelb, the Met's general manager, had hoped for an increased revenue stream from high-definition broadcasts, but those prospects were dashed when box office receipts turned out to be down 4% to $89.3 million. In the 5 years ending in July 2013. And attendance at the Lincoln Center Opera House fell by 17.5% in the same period. Those numbers created a grim reality, just as Mr. Gelb was about to renegotiate contracts with 15 unions. But as New Yorker contributor James B. Stewart explains in A Fight at the Opera, an article in the March 23rd issue of that magazine, he took an unusual strategy and narrowly avoided a lockout. Welcome back to our show, James.
Thanks. Nice to be with you as always.
There are 3,800 seats at the Met. Do we know how many of those seats are filled on an average night?
Yes. I mean, these numbers change every week, but the latest numbers I heard is it's running about 70% this year, which, by the way, is down from over 90%. Before Gelb came,
I just attended the revived production of Carmen, which is just brilliant, and got great reviews. It has an amazing cast, and I was surprised that there were so many empty seats.
Well, we're
talking Carmen with an all-star cast.
If you can't sell Carmen with an all-star cast, then something is clearly wrong. This is one of the great questions. I mean, the core of the financial problems at the Met is the declining box office. Something has to be done to address that. The causes of that, of course, has, many, many possible explanations, and no one seems to really know for sure.
But you try to look into some of them in this article.
Yes.
Peter Gelb is quoted as saying that they're doing everything to fill those seats. What kinds of strategies has he employed?
Well, I would say his primary strategy has been to bring in acclaimed stage directors, hand core and sometimes not core repertoire over them, and to do new productions to try to generate excitement, to try to generate press, to try to appeal to younger audiences, to try some fairly daring new things.
And have younger audiences been coming?
No, not based on any data I've seen. I mean, one thing we know for sure is audiences haven't been coming. You know, roughly eight to nine years into his tenure now, you can see that the box office has gone down. Maybe slightly younger people have been coming, but it's always been an old audience. It's still an old audience. There doesn't seem to have been any dramatic change.
And you quote Gelb as saying that the challenges that classical music and opera face are huge. It's an uphill struggle. This is not just a problem that opera is facing.
No.
Symphony orchestras are being cut back or being eliminated. We lost New York Opera last year.
That's kind of the great warning, story. The loss of a huge institution like New York City Opera was a shock to many people. And, of course, the fear is, could the same thing happen to the Met, which, we can talk about more. But classical music more broadly, there are mixed results about this. There is the sense globally that the kind of serious classical music, singing, opera, orchestras are facing a lot of problems. I don't think there's any question about that. But there are also signs of vitality. There are opera companies doing very well. There are orchestras doing very well. There are places that are drawing in new audiences, trying innovative things that do seem to be working. I think, my feeling is all my life classical music has been under some kind of threat.
Aren't there other kinds of problems? For example, a lot of operas last long into the night.
Yes, they
have big set changes that take a half hour apiece. Maybe the Met sells some of that awful champagne to fill the gap.
Teeny little,
for a lot of money,
cup.
Very bad stuff. But anyway, but it's hard to imagine bringing a younger audience with long operas mostly sung in foreign languages.
Well, there definitely are challenges there. I mean, I've always felt as a regular opera goer myself, and I love the opera, I love going, I even sit through these long things. But if you actually work, for a living, if you're looking at a six-hour Wagner epic, at the end of the day, you don't. If you're working, you don't have time to read the libretto, go out and have dinner, get a good night's sleep, and be ready for this sort of thing. I mean, it is a challenge if you're earning a living. And I think retirees are, you know, that's one of the reasons many of them are in the audience.
Didn't Gelb also tell you that even English language operas now require supertitles for the audience to understand the words?
Oh, that's true. I think anyone who's gone and heard an English language production understands that. I mean, but it's also true. You could be a native French speaker, and you still need the things to translate. Some languages are simply different than spoken languages. So, yes, you have the language barrier. You have the length. I do think there are things the opera could do to make it a little more congenial. I mean, having better food and drink options would certainly be a step in the right direction.
What about the price? How much is a ticket at the Met?
Well, the prices have, you know, they haven't kept up with the cost, but they've gone up dramatically. I think that the top price now is $475, I believe, for a seat. It's pushing up towards $500 a ticket. Now, there are many seats that are less than that, but, you know, for an average orchestra seat, you're still looking at $200 to $300.
You write that one reason Peter Gelb was hired by the Met was because he'd shown a flair for widening audiences for classical music. What were some of his achievements before he joined the Met?
Well, he did some daring, you know, marketing and publicity coups. He took Vladimir Horowitz back to the, you know, to Russia, then the Soviet Union, when he had been out of the country for a long time. He took an orchestra to China right after, you know, that opened up a little bit. So there he did do some, you know, attention getting. He attracted media publicity excitement in other genres of classical music.
But then when he did some of those things at the Met, like the production of Tosca, which you write about here, and also the productions of The Ring, that caused a lot of trouble.
Right. I think the lesson here is he has definitely brought more attention and more publicity, but all publicity is not necessarily good publicity. I don't know that the average PR person sometimes understands that, but at least in the classical music world, it's not. I mean, the Tosca, which had, first of all, it was replacing a much-loved traditional Franco Zeffirelli production. It brought in a very new, stripped-down, dark. It had prostitutes in Act Two. It had simulated sex on stage, and this wildly offended a lot of the old guard and people who traditionally have supported the Met.
Such as James S. Marcus.
Yes, he was a former chairman of the board, a potentially large donor, former Goldman Sachs executive, who was, you know, frankly horrified by... And he wasn't the only one. I think another very large, a board member, very large potential donor, and traditionally a very large donor, Jacqueline de Marais, was also very upset about this and wanted to see the Zeffirelli production brought back. And if it was one production, you know, maybe. But then The Ring came along, exorbitant cost. I mean, The Ring is kind of the touchstone of every opera direct manager's career, and this was pretty much a critical disaster.
It had an expensive and controversial set that required reinforcing the stage, among other things. This in a time when the Met was fully aware of the fact that it had financial problems.
Yeah, I mean, this, you know, with benefit of hindsight, certainly the whole Ring thing looks like a reckless exercise in hubris. Now, I will say in Gelb's behalf, he gives a very articulate defense of this production and what it was supposed to do. And when he describes it, it sounds great. Like, oh, this seems like fantastic. It does make sense in the abstract, but the abstract and reality are two different things. I think the reality of the production, many critics found it just utterly incomprehensible that this giant, and by the way, clanking machine sitting there kind of occasionally wiggling its beams.
Almost killed Deborah Voigt.
Well, I don't know if it said killed her, but she slipped down the plank. You know, the Valkyrie, instead of being on horses, were sitting on these planks and they were going up and down. I mean, it did look a little risky. And by the way, I saw the production and it looked like the singers all looked very nervous while this
Deborah
Voigt
says
on.
It was her fault, not the set.
She's been very gracious about it. But, I think you have to forget whether I liked it, you liked it, whether the critics liked it. What the problem is the audience has voted with their feet, and it had over 90% attendance when it opened. People were curious. They wanted to see the new thing, and then it went off a cliff. It was most recently at around 70%, which is unheard of for The Ring.
Aren't they caught in some kind of a bind if they revive the old production that goes back to the 50s or 60s? The critics complain, oh, this clanky old production. And if they do something new, then the traditionalists say, what has he done to my favorite opera?
Well, there's always that risk. I don't think there's anything new about that. And I don't think a manager can worry too much about the critics. Obviously, they do influence attendance. I mean, you know, a lot of the experiments have turned out quite well, like the new Madame Butterfly that was done by Anthony Minghella. I think everybody liked that. New, old, everyone in between. It's gorgeous. It's a fantastic production.
Now, obviously, Richard Eyre, who did The Carmen, that is quite brilliant.
Which is very well done. You know, so there have been some successes with these new things. I don't think that's the issue, really. At some point, you just have to look at the cost structure and say, this has got to be in line with revenues.
Well, they are caught in a bind when they do something like The Death of Klinghoffer, aren't they? Because on the one hand, they're trying to do new things that that will create a stir. On the other hand, it often causes a problem.
Well, Death of Klinghoffer certainly did create a stir. Again, was it a net positive? Let's put aside the political issues. I think, you know, people debate that. But, you know, again, the numbers just did not support that as a viable opera. You know, I went to
see
that.
So the publicity wasn't good?
I think it probably did help, but it didn't. You know, new operas face a real challenge, a brand new thing with a untested score and libretto. I mean, the problem, I think, when I was there, I would say a large number of the audience left after the first act, not because they were offended by it at all, because they were going to sleep. You know, the libretto is really challenging. Nothing happens. You know, it's kind of a relief when somebody finally shoots their gun in that thing. The people around me all woke up. I'm sorry, it was boring. The music, I think, is quite beautiful, but I don't think it is ever going to be a success, a financial success, and I don't think because it's controversial.
Perhaps an opera like that should be performed in a smaller venue. There are some operas that lend themselves to a 3,800-seat house and others that don't.
I think that's absolutely right. And you have to be aware that this is a very large auditorium. You want to fill the seats. And I think it's going to take, Gelb said that, you know, he'll change to the extent it's necessary. But it seems to me the numbers clearly show something does have to change. And somebody has to put some real analysis to what do New York audiences and international audiences, what are they willing to pay to go to the theater to see?
You were a founding editor of Smart Money in 1992. You still write for that magazine.
No, actually, I don't anymore.
Oh, you don't? Oh. Okay, well, you did until fairly recently. You're at the New Yorker writing mostly about business.
That's
right. So did you see this article as being about business or being about the crisis in opera and classical music?
Well, it all kind of blurs together at some point. But I did feel one thing I was trying to do was to get away from these sort of subjective evaluations. Is this a good production? Is this not? Do I like this or not? Let's just sweep that all aside, and let's just look at the financial numbers here. And one of the most shocking things to me, and a very worrisome sign that the board ought to get its hands around, is the declining endowment. The endowment went from a peak of about $365 million and has dwindled to less, $100 million less, at a time when the financial markets have been as buoyant as you could possibly hope for.
We're going to take a little break and come back to that, because I want to go into all of that in a lot more detail. James B. Stewart's article, A Fight at the Opera, is in the March 23rd edition of The New Yorker. We will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with James B. Stewart, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker, also writes for the New York Times and is the Bloomberg Professor of Business Journalism at Columbia University. His article, A Fight at the Opera, appeared in the March 23rd issue of The New Yorker. And as we've been saying, it is a mix of music and business reporting, the two in this case being inextricably tied to each other. When Peter Gelb entered the boardroom to address a group that included a 9-member committee of the Met Orchestra, whose contracts were due to expire on July 31st of last year, did he have a strategy?
Well, he did. He realized something had to be done. The revenues and the cost lines were out of control. They were not aligned in any way, which meant something had to be done. And the unionized labor costs amount to 2/3 of the total cost at the Met. So there's an obvious target for reducing costs. So he laid down the gauntlet right away, said, look, this is the dire situation we're in. Something's got to be done, and we're going to cut your salaries. We want a 16% cut. Now, you could argue, was that a smart strategy? I mean, that, of course, put them into – they were infuriated by this. But nevertheless, he certainly had a clear strategy from the get-go.
The unions felt that Gelb was spending too much money in other places. and that they were being asked to make the sacrifice.
Absolutely. They felt that, and then they did more research to try to reinforce their case, that the real problem was ineffective management, runaway costs, no controls over the expenses, and that you could bring the cost structure into alignment without having to cut their base pay.
But aren't some of the things also some of the costs augmented by board members and others? For example, the Ring had $20 million given as a gift by Ann Zift, who is the board chair.
Right.
So did that really take away from the bottom line?
Well, yes, in a sense it did. I mean, let me just say it's an extraordinary institution, as the chairman of the executive committee told me. It's not a business, really. I mean, it is a philanthropic endeavor, even though you pay for the tickets. But for every dollar you spend on a ticket, the Met loses another dollar. It's amazing that the costs are more than twice of what they bring in at the box office. So they need philanthropic support. Yes, you can say that paying for one production means that they didn't lose any money on that, but it's all coming out of the same pot. You know, you have to look at this total cost structure, the total revenue stream, and that's just another piece of the revenue stream.
Although some people claim that it costs a lot more than that gift of
yes.
$20 million, maybe over twice as much.
Over twice as much, because there are the indirect costs that wouldn't ordinarily, from an accounting standpoint, be assigned. For example, all the overtime that they had to spend on that then pushed other operas into additional overtime. And there's a kind of a domino effect of soaring costs.
You write, and I'm quoting, in the most recent fiscal year, 2013, the Met's expenses were $327 million, 47% higher than when Gelb took over. Why have expenses at the Met increased almost 50% at a time when the audiences are dwindling?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. It goes to the heart of the issues here. I mean, people will argue about that. Some of it certainly is the built-in increases in the union labor contracts, which Gelb couldn't control.
He inherited them from Volpe?
He inherited many of those until this time when he renegotiated them. Although they were renegotiated 4 years earlier while he was there, but Volpe still handled the negotiations. They're also the cost of all these new productions. New productions are expensive. And again, you can say, well, they're funded by donors, but again, it's all coming out of the same revenue stream. The quality, to maintain the quality, it is expensive. Nobody as a manager enjoys having to cut costs.
You mentioned the endowment. Doesn't the Met have a large endowment?
It doesn't have nearly a large enough endowment. And I think this is one of the most striking aspects of its recent financial performance and one of the most troublesome, that it's once fairly good endowment of over $350 million, which exceeded its then annual operating costs, has shrunk to somewhere around $250 million at a time when we have had very vibrant equity bond markets, when institutions have been realizing double-digit annualized returns. Theirs has gone down dramatically.
Because of the 2008 financial crisis?
Well, no, that certainly they took a hit on that, but it should have rebounded because of that. But it hasn't because because they've been spending the endowment to cover operating costs. Now, that is, every nonprofit institution tends to spend a percentage. 4.5% to 5.5% is considered prudent, that you can over time earn a greater return than that. So that doesn't deplete the principal of the endowment. The Met, however, prior to Gelb's arrival, decided instead of taking a percentage of the endowment every year, which is what they should do, they said, we're going to take a fixed sum of about $17 million per year. They were betting that markets would always go up. They should have known better. They have financial people on the board. But markets went down. Then, amazingly, even after Gelb got there, they increased that fixed draw from $17 million to $22 million a year, even after the financial crisis caused the endowment to drop. That, to me, no board should ever have allowed that.
Board members are supposed to contribute a minimum of $500,000 each year.
Yes.
I'm assuming some even give more.
Much more. The top donors give. I mean, Ann Ziff, who's the chairman, has been exceedingly generous. And by the way, I realize I've been critical of the board, and I think I should be for their failure to exact more financial discipline here. But I also want to say, thank them. I mean, they are doing this out of the generosity of their hearts, their love of opera, their love of making this available to New Yorkers, and they've given huge amounts of money. Ann Ziff has given you know, tens and tens of millions. I don't know what the total is, but it must be close to $50 million. And other Mercedes Bass, William Morris, head of the executive committee, they've given very, very large sums of money to make this art form viable.
Last summer, when this whole thing became news, many people said, well, it's just because the stagehands and the musicians get paid so much money.
Well,
more
they?
Than anybody else.
The stagehands were kind of curiously didn't get much attention in these negotiations. Some of their top people do make $400,000, $500,000 a year. Seems very substantial.
To me, anyway.
They argue about how much the orchestra and choristers actually make. I mean, the Met had one number, including overtime and benefits. They had, you know, their base salaries were around $200,000. Figuring the cost of living in New York, it seems like a really good sum, but it doesn't seem lavish. But, you know, let's face it, when the mediator came in here, he said, look, we've got to have some cuts on both sides. So we need some management cuts. We need some union cuts. The cost structure is too big. They had a principle of shared sacrifice, and he wanted everyone to participate in that.
When Gelb was facing representatives of the orchestra, he laid out the balance sheet issues and made it clear that in 2 to 3 years, the Met could face bankruptcy. Was this to buffer his request that all 15 unions contribute to cutting labor costs by 16%?
Yes, I think that was very much a part of his strategy to make a dire warning like that. I mean, and after all, he has the example of New York City Opera across the plaza as a rather dire example that such a thing could actually happen. It's not unthinkable.
Well, how much of the Met's budget goes to labor costs?
About two-thirds. So, you know, it is if you're going to look at places to cut, it's, you know, it doesn't take a financial genius to see that some of it probably has to come out of the labor costs. But the unions argued, and I think persuasively, that a lot of their pay was the result of bad management decisions. For example, programming a huge number of these epically long operas that required their overtime pay to soar. Now, that is within management's control. So there are, you know, there are arguments to be made on both sides there that you could have kept the cost down with more prudent management.
I have noticed that some of the productions now have cut down on the number of acts. They merge a couple of acts, simply close the curtain and use a revolving stage or something, a turntable, to come up with another set. In the past, you just waited between each of the acts. Sometimes there were four or five acts.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of some operas. There were a few where I calculated that I spent more time in intermission milling around there than I did sitting in my seat during the opera. I think that's an improvement, by the way. I think that is a response, actually, to audience complaints that, you know, what do you do at intermission?
You're right that Joseph Volpe had been kept on as a paid consultant after he left the general manager's post, and he had run the contract negotiations at the Met for the past 28 years, making some of the decisions that you have been critical of. What was his role in these negotiations?
Well, at the very beginning, he started out, I think he was going to handle these negotiations as he had in the past, but then he clashed with Gelb. They'd never really gotten along, and then, you know, who knows exactly what happened, but they parted ways, and he decided not to do these negotiations.
So how did they avoid a lockout? It looked like it was very close.
I think it was very close, and that's all the leverage the Met really had. But at the last minute, you know, the board, the management, they didn't really want the theater to go dark. I mean, the consequences of that could have been very dire and lost audiences. And so they decided to have a mediator come in, and they kind of then, once the mediator was in, they decided, well, we can find some common ground here. And to some extent, they did. I mean, they did get salary cuts, and the management is cutting costs. And they do have a guy in there overseeing the compliance with this. So they did find common ground.
And fewer productions and fewer new productions.
Well, one fewer new production, and I believe two fewer productions overall. I think the orchestra and the chorus probably would have wanted to see more deep cuts there. But they did reach this accord, but I have to say that the bitterness has not gone away. There is still much animosity up there.
On the other hand, I think audiences come to expect seeing a production with hundreds of people on the stage, perhaps one of the greatest orchestras in the world, backing up the greatest singers in the world.
I'm glad
that's
you
the price
that.
You have to pay for that.
I'm glad you made that point, because I have to say, to everyone's credit there, however hostile they are, they have kept the quality up. No one feels at this point that this is anything but still one of the great opera companies in the world.
James B. Stewart's article in The New Yorker, A Fight at the Opera, appeared in the March 23rd edition of the magazine. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Sure.
Again.
Pleasure.